Judge Bauer and I are pleased to welcome today Judge Robert Miller of the Northern District of Indiana to share in this court's work. The first cases for today are three consolidated appeals, 10-2057, 11-1393, 11-3597, Grachesinski v. Mayor Brown, and many other parties. Mr. Joyce.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ed Joyce, and I represent the estate of CMGT and the court-appointed trustee in a legal malpractice breach of fiduciary duty case which the trustee filed against Mayor Brown. Count one of that case alleges essentially that but for the defendant's negligence, Spahart Capital never would have filed a case in California, never would have obtained an injunction, never would have obtained a default, a judgment, and that CMGT never would have been put into bankruptcy. Count two, on the other hand, says that but for the negligence of Mayor Brown and Platt, once Spahart Capital filed this case, they never would have gotten an injunction, they never would have gotten a $17 million default judgment, and again, CMGT would not have been put into bankruptcy. Now, it's not even necessary to pass on the merits of those claims to decide this appeal. And in fact, the district court below was asked in a motion to dismiss to pass on these claims, and she found them to be appropriate. Okay. The problem, as we see it, is that the district court, essentially on its own motion, decided to make an analysis of whether or not the contested facts as presented to her would support a judicial estoppel. Okay. After Mayor Brown lost the motion to dismiss, they raised an absurd result argument to the court, arguing that it would be an absurd result if they were required to pay money to CMGT when the principal beneficiary of that payment would be Spahart Capital. We submit, Your Honor, that the only absurd result that is here is the absurd result requested by the defendants. When you look at the facts, the basically uncontested facts, you've got a situation where there's a bankruptcy filed involuntarily by Spahart Capital. They've obtained a default judgment against CMGT. There's a Chapter 7 trustee appointed to administer the estate. Trustee is contacted by a law school classmate who happens to represent Spahart Capital, and he suggests to the trustee that there's a substantial legal malpractice claim here, and if the claim is pursued successfully, there will be money to benefit the unsecured creditors. Okay. So negotiations then commence between the trustee and counsel for Spahart Capital. What the trustee makes very clear is he is not prepared to engage a lawyer to pursue a legal malpractice case where the only beneficiary is going to be someone who claims to be a secured creditor. At that point in time, the trustee did not know if Spahart Capital was in fact a secured creditor, but they claimed to be.
Yeah, let me just ask real quickly. The communication there is among several facts in your brief that aren't referred to in the district court's opinion. How were those facts placed before the district court?
That's one of the biggest problems. Since the parties were not aware that the court was pursuing its own analysis of a potential judicial estoppel claim, the parties were not asked to comment on many of the facts that the court concluded were facts. She concluded they were facts to support her conclusion that there should be a summary judgment. So you don't really see a lot of these facts until the appellate court.
Okay, so since you didn't know you needed to put those facts before her, you hadn't done so?
That is correct.
Okay.
And we responded to a motion to dismiss. We then responded to an unclean hands argument We never thought we were responding to a situation where a court was looking at judicial estoppel, especially in a situation where, in order to have judicial estoppel, the court would have to conclude that the trustee was a proxy for Spehar and that Spehar controlled the trustee. So you won't find any facts in the trial court dealing with this control issue, which is the key issue in terms of whether there's a proxy. But what you have is you have the trustee negotiating with Spehar Capital. The negotiations lead to an agreement where Spehar will subordinate part of its secured position if it has one. It will make a very limited $18,000 payment to the court to fund some administrative costs. And at that point, the trustee is in the position where he's told but has no idea that there's a valid legal malpractice claim to pursue.
Mr. Joyce, let me ask you, what's your best authority for having the courts allow, in essence, collection of a judgment here based on the theory that the judgment never should have been entered?
Well, our best authority is in our count one, we point out the various facts that show that but for the negligence of Mayor Brown, there would never have been a judgment. Okay. And we show
I understand that, but we also know that if you get a judgment on the malpractice claim, 90% or so of the proceeds would go to Spehar Capital. Correct?
Possibility. It's actually
what your sharing agreement provides for, doesn't it?
Our sharing agreement provides that Spehar Capital will give up part of its secured position if it has one. But the point you're raising, which is the point I want to...
The sharing agreement has a long table about how net proceeds would be divided, and roughly 90% would go to Spehar Capital, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. What's your best authority for allowing courts to be used to collect that judgment on the theory collected for the benefit of Spehar Capital on the theory that it never should have been entered? This is the fundamental problem that the defendants have been raising all along.
Well, could I say one thing first?
Sure.
Okay. The way we look at the facts is if, in fact, Spehar Capital did something inappropriate or wrong, as suggested by the defendants, the proper remedy would have been to go to the bankruptcy court, have their position subordinated, so they, in fact, are not secured, and they, in fact, do not get the lion's share. But what the trustees confronted with is...
That agreement has already been reached in the... they weren't a party to that agreement in the bankruptcy court, right? That's between the trustee and Spehar Capital, and with the approval of the bankruptcy court, Mayor Brown has nothing to do with it. Now, let's go back to my question. Can you answer that, please?
Objected because they had notice of that.
Okay. Could you answer my question?
To me, it's just standard legal malpractice law that if the negligence of an attorney causes a result that injures the client, there's a claim.
Okay, that's... Well, I think that really kind of hits the fundamental point that troubles me here. And it seems to me the real issue is whether the client can recover damages for malpractice when the client has not actually paid any money.
But the real issue here is this is the only vehicle to permit the unsecured to collect anything on their claims.
That's not the question. How is the client? The client hasn't paid a penny on this judgment, correct?
That is correct. CMGT has paid nothing.
So, under Illinois malpractice law, how is there any viable claim?
Because you determine the extent to which the malpractice damaged CMGT, and in count one you would show what CMGT was worth and what was lost.
Nothing.
That is absolutely not true.
It had no assets. It was deeply in debt.
It actually had a lot of assets. It had three very successful contracts. It had successful software.
It was dead without the financing, right?
That is correct. Without financing, it would be dead.
Okay. And the Illinois courts have said, in essence, the legal malpractice action places the plaintiff in the same position he or she would have occupied but for the attorney's negligence. That's from the Sterling Capital case, but it's a general proposition.
The allegation is that, I apologize.
The position the company was in was no, well, at least dead in the water unless it could get the financing that was blocked by the judgment that you're saying should never have been entered.
Correct. The position the company was in is they were about to close a $2.5 million financing that would permit this company by a different name to go forward with its business. But for the negligence, that transaction would have closed.
But for Spehar Capital's lawsuit, it would have closed as well.
That is correct. But it's the negligence of Mayor Brown that caused the lawsuit to be filed.
It caused the lawsuit to be filed?
Absolutely. Spehar Capital endeavored to resolve this issue, to settle this issue, pre-filing, and the company put Mayor Brown in charge of those negotiations.
Well, the company had no money, though, right? Spehar wasn't going to settle without money, right?
Spehar was looking to participate in a fund of money that would be paid by the new investors. That was his claim. So if they settled with Spehar by saying, look, we'll give you a fund of that money. We'll honor your contract. We'll make some deal with you. He was crying out to make a deal, and at this point, facts are that Mayor Brown rebuffed that, said we're not going to talk to you. We're not going to make a deal. So when you tell someone who thinks they've got
Without Mr. Franco's knowledge or participation?
Franco,
those are strategic decisions a client makes.
Franco put Mayor Brown in charge of making those decisions. Mayor Brown did. Okay. Now, if Mayor Brown had tried to negotiate a settlement on behalf of the client and nothing happened, it would be a different situation. They blocked any attempt to settle. All Spehar wanted, and he sent many emails and many telephone calls along these lines, is to get some settlement. Recognize my contractual right. And when the company is told, we're not going to recognize your contractual right, do what you have to do, they litigate.
Do you have any? Oh, go ahead.
When I set down your brief, and my understanding was that the claimed breach of professional care by Mayor Brown was not appearing and defending in the California suit. It goes beyond that. You're saying that they should have resolved this before suit was
correct.
Filed?
Correct. In count one anticipates that but for their malpractice, there would not have been a suit. If they had not just totally turned off any efforts to settle this case, then there would not have been a suit. So the next double is, after making those negligent decisions, a suit is filed, and you're confronted with a situation where if something isn't done with an injunction suit pending in California, there will be a default judgment. I'm sorry, there'll be an injunction. That injunction will clearly prevent
the request of Spehar Capital.
Yes. But that injunction will prevent the financing from going forward, and the company will be.
And it was always clear, wasn't it, that Mayor Brown was not going to appear in that lawsuit, and that if somebody from CMGT wanted to defend that lawsuit, they could have come up with money to do so, right?
What's clear from the records right now is that it was part of a strategy of Mayor Brown to not appear. They instead were going to defend the case in Illinois when they came here to collect. The strategy also appears to be that Mayor Brown decided to stop representing CMGT instead of representing Mayor Brown and Franco, because as soon as Spehar made this threat of a litigation, Mayor Brown quickly approached the new financing source and said, look, there's a better deal we can make here. You pay our fee, you hire Franco, you can get everything you want by paying nothing.
Thank you, Mr. Joyce. Mr. Clenda?
Thank you, Ron.
May it please the Court, I'm Stephen Clenda, and I represent Gary Spehar. I'd like to make only three brief points with respect to intervention. First, Spehar could not have known that his honesty was at issue below before the district court denied defendants' motion to dismiss, because that denial said that perjury was not presented by the facts or arguments that defendants forwarded to support dismissal. Second, the defendants forwarded to support dismissal. In other words, there was nothing that defendants forwarded in their motion to dismiss that supported an allegation that Spehar lied to the California court.
How much could those such things be considered on a 12B6 motion anyway?
Well, the district court believed that defendants were alleging perjury and said that there was nothing to support it. And so Spehar can't have had notice that he lied when the district court said that the allegation was never at issue.
He knew the accusation was made, though.
Pardon?
He knew the accusation was
he
made.
He did not know the accusation was made.
Let me ask you, Mr. Klenda, let's take a very different kind of case. Civil case against a police officer for an unlawful arrest. His partner testifies at trial. The district court ultimately makes findings that the witness, police officer, was not a credible witness and was not an honest witness. Does that police officer then have the right to intervene, set aside the judgment, and start over?
Different facts here.
What's different about it?
Because Mr. Spehar has a protected liberty interest in the fact that those...
Well, a police officer. I mean,
because
the court finds a police officer lied, that can have a devastating effect on that officer's career.
But here we have a situation. Here we have a situation in which Spehar presented to the district court evidence that he was effectively blacklisted from employment in his chosen profession. Reputation would be harmed.
What is different? As Judge Miller suggests, suppose you get a similar finding about an expert witness.
Well, the expert witness would be making an amorphous representation about something he won't be able to earn enough, or his professional reputation would be harmed, much like the police officers would be harmed. What's different here is that Spehar presented an affidavit from an executive, an experienced executive in the investment banking industry, saying that Spehar was effectively unemployable. And as a result,
under an expert witness or a police officer, I don't see the difference.
To that extent, I would say that the police officer then would have a claim, yes. If he was effective,
a district judge makes a finding that a witness lied with adverse career effects, the judgment can be set aside, has to be set aside at the instance of that witness.
No, I disagree with the
court. Start over again. That's what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that. I disagree with the court's characterization. What I'm saying is that under Townsend v. Vallis, if a employee is effectively blacklisted from employment in his chosen profession, not subject to disciplinary conflict, not subject to just a loss of income or loss of professional representation, that presents a protected liberty interest, and that's the evidence that Spehar presented that makes this case different. Second point is that Spehar couldn't have known his honesty was at issue below after the district court denied dismissal because the courts and defendants both agreed that unclean hands discovery concerned the trustee's conduct, not Spehar's. My final point is that even if the court reverses, the briefs before it show that the trustee's inadequate representation of Spehar would continue to put, and here's the key point, Spehar's employability in his chosen profession at risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klenda. Mr. Novak, for defendants, cross appellants.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Your Honors, this case was absurd and backwards at every step of the way, indeed at every possible level. It all started with a commission-based broker, Spehar Capital, that could get paid, if at all, only if the Trotner deal closed, but who successfully sued to stop that very deal from closing. Then, by misrepresenting that CMGT, which was at death's door, was worth over $100 million, Spehar turned its claim for a commission from a $500,000 deal into a $17 million default judgment. Next, Spehar filed the involuntary bankruptcy to try to turn its claim, which it knew was uncollectible from the get-go, into a collectible legal malpractice case against the judgment debtor's lawyer for allegedly failing to defend the underlying uncollectible claim. Then the bankruptcy trustee partners with Spehar to bring the malpractice claim, promising to give Spehar the lion's share of any recovery, even though under Illinois malpractice law there could be no recovery unless it was first determined that Spehar should not have succeeded on its underlying claim in the first place. And even the argument that the other creditors could get some of this, that would still be a windfall because no one, no creditor, CMGT, nobody has ever paid or will ever pay even one penny of that $17 million judgment. And under Illinois law, actual money damages, as Your Honor has stated, is a necessary element for such a claim. So the malpractice claim itself was always doomed from the beginning.
Mr. Novak, I understand the district court's concern about the use of the courts in this way. I have some concerns, however, about either the judicial estoppel or other theories for reaching that result. Let me just ask you one preliminary question. When we're talking about judicial estoppel, do you think we're talking about federal law or state law?
We submit it's federal law, and for a couple reasons. First of all, since it is a federal court in which this consequence is occurring, the federal court has the interest in applying that doctrine. Secondly,
host court, in essence, for the...
That's a good way to say it, better than I just did. Okay. The other reason is that it's probably a moot issue because Illinois law, basic judicial estoppel laws, is the same.
I guess let me try to get at this a somewhat different way. I guess I'm concerned about the extent to which your judicial estoppel theory or your unclean hands defense, as you presented it in the district court, depends upon the proportion of recovery that would go to Spehar Capital. Suppose we imagine some different circumstances where it's half or 10% because other creditors have other strong claims. Wouldn't that seem to reduce the compelling force of the argument?
First of all, that's only one of our reasons, and I'll come back to the others, but to directly answer Your Honor's question, this court in Maxwell 1 has really answered the question, because in Maxwell 1, the shareholders who were going to recover and who the court believed should not recover would have gotten 57%, not 80 or 90%. So our case is even stronger than
that. I mean, that really wasn't the basis for the final decision in Maxwell, was it?
Well, it was one of the bases, and it certainly is we would submit the law of this circuit that a creditor cannot be at the same time the cause of the bankruptcy and the primary beneficiary. Here, whether it's 90%, 85%, 80%, Spehar is going to be the primary. But, Your Honor, it is a major part of our case to say that Spehar was going to get it. It's not the only thing that's absurd here. What's absurd here, in addition, is the fact that CMGT, the day before the default judgment, was worthless. It didn't have anything. It was going out of business. It had no financing. According to the theory of this malpractice case, the day after the default judgment, it had a $17 million asset. So the argument is that by virtue of the alleged malpractice, CMGT should be put in a better position than it would have been had there been no malpractice. That goes against all precepts of malpractice law, especially under Illinois law. Your Honor's observation about the Sterling Radio case is right on, because that...
Well, could you address more specifically the trustee's argument, however, that the real damage here was caused by the fact that the lawsuit even got filed in the first place, that there was a failure to settle?
If I may, Your Honor, there are actually three reasons why that argument fails. And remember, what's being urged is that count one saves the summary judgment. But let me tell you why there's three reasons why that's not right. First of all, that argument has been waived. That was made in response to the motion to dismiss, which was a different animal than summary judgment. When we filed our summary judgment and there was exhaustive briefing, not one word was said that, Judge, whatever you do, don't throw out count one. This is all about count two. This is a count two summary judgment motion. That argument wasn't made below.
I assume you moved us to the whole claim.
We did. We did. But they didn't oppose it on the grounds that count one's different than count two. The whole thrust of the briefing was their argument that the default judgment didn't count, didn't create any absurdity. In the briefs on this appeal, there has been no argument that count one saves the case. The only mention of count one is in the statement of facts, where they recite what the complaint said and the position they took. There's no request, for example, you can scour these briefs throughout, there's no request that says, but even if you affirm summary judgment on count two, remand the case for further proceedings on count one. That hasn't been made. This case morphed into the default judgment in count two. That's what they defended on. That's what they did, and they've waived the other. The second reason is that...
Can I just ask you real quick on that waiver in the district court? Mr. Joyce suggests that this judicial estoppel theory came out of the blue, that they didn't have a chance to respond to it. The district judge said that the crux of your argument, although you hadn't called it that, was judicial estoppel. What was the argument whose crux, as you understand it, would be judicial estoppel? What was the argument that you were making in the district court?
Well, we argued in the district court expressly, and it was a major part of our motion, that it was inconsistent and absurd to pursue a malpractice case on the basis that the judgment shouldn't have been entered, the default judgment shouldn't have been entered, when the recipient of the benefits of that malpractice case took the opposite position and could have only won if his claim was valid. So we pointed out that inconsistency. Our label was absurdity, fraud on the court, and the like. But the facts that we based it on, the arguments we based it on, were the exact same arguments and facts that the judge granted the motion on, albeit she called it judicial estoppel.
And that includes the idea that the trustee was basically a placeholder for Spehar Capital?
Absolutely. We had to argue that the absurdity here is everything was being done for Spehar and with Spehar's active involvement. So we made all the arguments that would lead to the judge's conclusion that, to use her colorful language, that Spehar was the puppeteer and Grochaczynski simply the puppet. So the answer is all those facts were before the court.
Would you go back to your other reasons on count one?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. The second reason is that dismissal with prejudice as a sanction under the court's inherent authority can occur even if the fraud on the court or whatever grounds it was that justifies a dismissal was only on part of a case. A court can say, look, you have attempted to defraud this court, you've attacked the integrity of this court, you have perverted the court, all words that come out of this opinion, albeit called judicial estoppel. And then Judge Kendall went from that, and if you look on page 31 of her opinion, the penultimate paragraph on that page, it starts with, I think, although. She is saying that there is this overarching fraud, and she says, I'm entering summary judgment on both counts. And that's what she says on page 33. So that you could affirm this on the basis of inherent authority that reaches count one, even though the focus in that briefing was count two. And in all events, my third reason is that the failure to settle, the failure to give advice to say, hey, you ought to settle instead of suing as opposed to defending instead of settling, those are matters of attorney judgment. That is the stuff, that is not the stuff, I should say, of which malpractice is made. And we cited the Illinois law that says matters of judgment, where it's an attorney has exercising judgment, assessing risk, advising on strategies and the like, which would include, of course, whether to settle, those matters of judgment will not support malpractice. So under any of those three reasons, count one doesn't save the day. And so if we go back to the litany of absurdity, we get to the damages point, and I think that's where I might have been. In Illinois law, and Sterling Radio, Your Honor, confirms it. Indeed, in Sterling Radio, that's the closest case to our facts. Because in Sterling Radio, there was a judgment. It was satisfied by the co-defendant's assignee, so that, just like in our case, albeit for a different reason, but just like in our case, the judgment will never get paid. The cases that the trustee cited, Fox and Gruzzi, those don't change the outcome here because in Fox there had been partial payment, and at the time of the lawsuit there were still ongoing and active collection efforts to get more. Gruzzi, found that an unsatisfied judgment could support damages, but it qualified that holding, quote, by the words, quote, absent any evidence to the contrary. And, of course, in our case, just like in Sterling Radio, there is evidence to the contrary by reason of the fact that no payments have been made and no payments can be made because of the bankruptcy. It'll never be paid. And Sterling Radio, by the way, comes later than Gruzzi. And now, Your Honors, if that weren't enough, and that's the ones we relied on in the district court, in the trustee's reply brief in this appeal, pages 14 to 15, the trustee effectively concedes that there was no jurisdiction in the California court because they say in the reply brief, one of the things we're going to prove to win our malpractice case is that the defendant should have gone there and made an affirmative defense, lack of jurisdiction. And in order to win the malpractice, they'd have to prove that there indeed was no jurisdiction. But under California law, a judgment without personal jurisdiction is void. It's of no force or effect.
Isn't it pretty clear, though, that the California court had jurisdiction? Spehar was based in California. There was an ongoing contractual relationship with CMGT. He was doing his work under the contract from there. That's usually a minimal contact enough to support jurisdiction.
Judge, I think if that record had been developed, and I concede that it hasn't been, that there would be enough to say no jurisdiction, because CMGT was an Illinois company, headquartered in Illinois, doing all of its work in Illinois, and the mere fact that you have a California party to the contract, and we cited a case or two on that, doesn't give jurisdiction. But you don't have to reach that because...
We do that a lot.
I would suggest that in this case...
Burger King probably gets your jurisdiction in California. I mean, I think the whole jurisdiction thing is a red herring.
Okay, then I'll move away from it. But I think there's an admission by them that there was no jurisdiction, but I'll move off of that. And, Judge, Your Honors, Judge Kendall saw through these various absurdities. She knew there was something wrong with this case, and she needed to find a legal rubric. She chose judicial estoppel, perfectly defensible, based on, if you will, the same facts and arguments as our other defenses. But that's what she picked, and the law, you know, in Ray Cassidy, this court said, a judge can raise judicial estoppel on its own motion. So that ground is there. That's the ground on which to affirm. There are, in addition, several other grounds. And let me address all the grounds. The first ground is the judicial estoppel. The inconsistent position should be very clear. In the California suit, the first position was that Spehar's claim was valid and should succeed. In the malpractice case, exactly the opposite. It should not have succeeded. The trustee's only argument, the trustee doesn't say there's not an inconsistency. The trustee says that it has to be the same party taking both positions. There's no case cited that holds that, and the only authority that they do cite is the Supreme Court's Taylor decision, but that was not a judicial estoppel case. That's res judicata.
It's essentially the same problem, though, right? Mm. The same problem in terms of holding one party responsible for the results of another party's activities in court.
I would say it's sort of the same problem, but for different purposes. The purpose of res judicata and collateral estoppel is to protect parties. The purpose of judicial estoppel is to protect the courts and the entire judicial system. And for that reason, the cases that we cited where there is no requirement of same party have emphasized that it doesn't matter because what we're doing is we're protecting the courts. And so in this case where Spehar was joined at the hip with Grochaczynski, and they were really one and the same party here, one acting for the other, the judicial estoppel doctrine should apply. And the court says, Supreme Court on down, there's no rigid rules. What you look at is, basically, is there something wrong here? Is it fast and loose with the courts? Is the integrity of the system going to be upset if we've got one result here and another result there? I would submit to the court that that's exactly the case here and why that doctrine should be applied. A second basis for affirmance is this court's analysis of Maxwell 1, where you had two principles at play, both of which defeat the claim. One, and we've alluded to it already, the cause of the bankruptcy shouldn't be the beneficiary. And the second is that the courts must be vigilant in policing bankruptcy trustees' exercise of litigation judgment. And here, litigation judgment was out the door for any number of reasons. I mean, just take one example. They file a complaint that says that there's a signed deal or a letter of intent with the Washoe tribe. They attach an unsigned version, meaning, well, there is one, but we just don't have it attached. Spehar tells Joyce there's never been a signed one, his own guy, and they still keep that in to the end of the case. In addition, the trustee failed to exercise reasonable judgment every step of the way after that. Trustee shouldn't have pursued this claim in the first place for the reasons we've already said under Maxwell, should have vacated the judgment, particularly when the California judge as much as invited it, and when the trustee himself said under oath it was in the estate's interest to do that. But instead, he waited until after the time ran to spend a half hour reading a statute and doing nothing else. There was no real investigation. Everything came from Spehar. Imagine a malpractice case where you don't go and ask the client, was he supposed to do this? Did he do anything wrong? They never talk to the client. They talk to the enemy, Spehar. That's not good litigation judgment. And finally, Your Honors can affirm on inherent authority. This court has repeatedly affirmed dismissals with prejudice where bad conduct has occurred in the case, and that's what we've got here. Let me just make a couple quick points on sanctions and intervention as I'm heading toward the end of my time. The one thing I want to say, in addition to everything that's in the brief, which we reserve, of course, is that the question of what standard to apply to the trustee's conduct, and the court applied willful and deliberate, is a question of law. It is to be reviewed de novo by this court. And it was air to apply the willful standard because that's what you apply when you're testing whether there's been a breach of fiduciary duty by the trustee in conducting the business of the estate. Once litigation is implicated and the federal court is implicated, the trustee is just like every other litigant. He's not a super litigant that gets to do things inconsistent with our federal rules. Governments have immunity from tort. But in a case, if we had a case where there was an immunity defense raised by the government, but the government forged the document to win its immunity defense, it would not be immune from litigation sanctions. And I know that
Mr. Novak, your time has expired. I just want to ask you one quick question. Why didn't you guys use Rule 11? Where you get the warning shot, it seems to me you're asking us to substitute and asking the district judge to substitute for a perfectly appropriate procedure that you could have taken advantage of?
Judge, actually, not really. We could not have gotten relief, full relief under Rule 11, because Rule 11 has been interpreted by this court and many other courts not to apply to pleadings that are filed and signed in the state court.
But the further pursuit of them obviously is. Okay.
So okay. We couldn't have given a notice to withdraw that state court complaint. The first time that we could have done a Rule 11 is when they opposed our motion to dismiss.
Okay.
But the judge denied that motion to dismiss. We couldn't do it.
Please. Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Novak.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Let's see. How do counsel want to divide your remaining time here? Is it
3 minutes for Mr. Douglas is the individual that's cross-examined.
Okay. Mr. Morgans? Okay.
May it please the Court? I'm David Morgans. I represent David Grokosinski individually. The question before the case, before the court on this aspect of the case, is solely whether the district court abused its discretion in denying sanctions to Grokosinski. That means that this court has to find, in order to reverse it, that no reasonable person would agree with the district court's ruling. The district court found there should be no sanctions against Mr. Grokosinski individually, both under inherent authority and under the willful and deliberate standard. It discussed mostly the willful and deliberate standard and the Maxwell cases in its opinion, but it also noted that even if you eliminated willful and deliberate, the district court's judgment was under its inherent authority, Mr. Grokosinski should not be sanctioned. Now, the court had before it, the district court had before it, not just the summary judgment opinion that it had earlier rendered, but Mr. Grokosinski's affidavit that explained all this and put it in context and showed that from his standpoint, he used appropriate judgment in relying upon counsel appointed by the bankruptcy court to assist him in this type of a case.
Didn't the trustee, though, in the district court on these issues invoke the attorney-client privilege in his communications with Mr. Joyce and his firm and disavow any advice of counsel defense?
It is true that that was done by counsel for Mr. Grokosinski as trustee. And the ramification of it is this. There was no objection to Mr. Grokosinski's affidavit in the reply on the sanctions motion on that basis. Therefore, it's been waived. And I checked that.
But for that, you think there would have been a problem?
I don't think there would have been a problem, no, because the fact that the trustee who the attorney for the trustee does not have the same interest as Mr. Grokosinski individually.
Well, I mean, there's a problem, though, isn't there? In if the attorney and the client are disagreeing on this issue in front of the district court as to whether there ought to be a waiver of the attorney-client privilege, right?
Well, there is, but at that point, Mr. Grokosinski was not an individual party to the lawsuit. He became an individual party when the motion for sanctions was brought. The basically, Your Honors, as I said, the bankruptcy court allows the use of professionals. Judge Kendall found that under Maxwell II, which was persuasive, although not precedential, this was an appropriate use of counsel. Mr. Grokosinski was acting in the best interest of the unsecured creditors as he saw it. He didn't participate in any of the shenanigans that are alleged on the part of Mr. Spehar. They were all imputed to him. He also, in hiring Mr. Joyce, he checked his credentials. He had Mr. Joyce as a contingent fee lawyer who's got skin in the game in the sense that he puts his own time and effort and his firm's time and effort into something, unlike the lawyer in Maxwell, who was on an hourly fee. That makes it more appropriate to rely on the advice of counsel in this case and rely on Mr. Joyce. Thank you.
Mr. Joyce, we asked you a lot of questions. How much time does he have left? 1 minute. One extra minute.
Thought I had six.
You used all your time. Oh. We asked you a lot of questions. You got one extra minute.
Okay, let me be quick as I can be. You asked me any cases that would support the notion in Illinois in a malpractice case that a client could sue a lawyer where the client didn't pay the judgment. There's two cases that we cite in our brief. Grouse versus Bellini is an Illinois case, 46 Illinois 2nd. I'm sorry, near Northeast 2nd.
Bruce and Fox cases?
Correct. Okay. The notion that the company was worthless and therefore this is really absurd, pending before CMGT was a $2.5 million closing, so at least some third party thought this company was worth at least $2.5 million. And, of course, they negotiated that contract when the company was in extremis. There's been a statement here that every single fact we relied upon came from Spehar, and, in fact, it's his complaint. We pointed out to the district court that we had in our possession the CMGT records, the Mayor Brown records. In fact, we attached, I think, 30 of them to the complaint. This was a state court fact-intensive pleading case. And we based our case essentially on the facts as disclosed in contemporaneous documents.
Thank you, Mr. Joyce.
Thank you, Judge.
Cases are taken under advisement.